From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West.
I'm Doug Fabrizio. Here's how we're observing the 150th anniversary of the meeting of the Transcontinental Railroad by showing a movie. Cecil B. DeMille's Union Pacific from 1939. Most of this was shot in Utah. This is part of our film series with the Utah Film Center. We're screening it next week. Today in the program, the film historian James Dark will join us to take us through the story of Union Pacific. We'll be right back.
KUER's Community Calendar is a resource where you can find hundreds of events happening across Utah. You can learn a new skill in workshops, experience art and performances offered across the state, scout family-friendly events and activities, and a whole lot more. You can also share your own events. Just fill out the form. It's all on our website, KUER.org. Just click Community Calendar under the Events tab.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A lot of talk this week about trains. Everyone trying to put a spin on the occasion of the 150th anniversary of the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad at Promontory Point in 1869. Well, here's our spin. A movie. A bona fide epic from the golden age of Hollywood made by the master Cecil B. DeMille. It premiered in 1939, the same year of Gone with the Wind. It's called Union Pacific, and we are going to screen it as part of our film series, our partnership with Utah Film Center. And if you come see it next Wednesday night at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center, you will see a classic Western, cowboys and Indians, the strong, silent hero and the big hat, and the trains, of course. DeMille built his epic around the story of the final stretch in the Transcontinental Railroad, and a good part of the movie was shot in Utah, down near Cedar City, to be exact. So today in the program, we've invited the film historian James Dark to join us to talk about DeMille's Union Pacific. We'll give you more details about the screening a little later on the program. James Dark is a film historian and emeritus film archivist at Brigham Young University. He's the author of the book When Hollywood Came to Utah, which is being released in a new updated edition this summer. And when you're talking about a movie, you've got to begin with the plot.
Cecil B. DeMille's Union Pacific was released in 1939, considered to be one of the best years for Hollywood motion pictures ever. It was a very big epic-scale film of the building of the Transcontinental Railroad with, naturally, because of its title, the emphasis on the Union Pacific Railroad, not necessarily the Central Pacific. And it had to do with a triangular love affair. It had to do with corporate greed and their interests in making money off the building of the Transcontinental Railroad from 1863 to 1869. And a love affair between the troubleshooter on the Union Pacific, played by Joel McRae, Jeff Butler, and Barbara Stanwyck, a fiery-tempered Irish postmistress on the Union Pacific line, and a very evil henchman named Sid Campo, played by Brian Donlevy, who's trying to stall and sabotage the efforts of Union Pacific to reach Promontory Point near Ogden, Utah.
Yeah. Put Cecil B. DeMille in perspective for the time, 1939. And one of the things you've talked about is, and this helped me, I think, understand where he fit, he was kind of like the Spielberg of his time in some way.
Cecil B. DeMille has largely been forgotten by the general public, but he was the greatest producer-director of his time. He made more than 70 feature motion pictures from 1913 to 1956. And even though his best remembered films are religious oriented, and I'm referring here to The Ten Commandments in 1956, starring Charlton Heston, he only made 5 specifically religious oriented films out of his total of 70 motion pictures.
Wow.
They include Samson and Delilah, The Sign of the Cross, The Crusades, 2 versions of The Ten Commandments, 1923 and 1956. But he made a lot of Westerns, and he knew how to make them, and Union Pacific is, in my opinion, his best Western and a really good film that plays well in 2019.
What did he like about Westerns, do you know? What did he like about the genre? Was it just that it was particularly popular then, or was there something about it that he liked?
Westerns were very popular in America in the 1920s and 30s, and especially in the 1930s, a number of Westerns were made, I think because they were symbolic of America coming out of the Depression. Hmm. And stories of the Old West have to do mostly with going from a state of chaos in the lawless West into a state of order and civilization. And that describes perfectly how America was coming out of the chaotic era of the early Great Depression in the early 1930s. And we're beginning to see the light at the end of the tunnel, if I can mix metaphors, at the end of the decade in 1939. And there were several railroad-oriented motion pictures towards the end of the 1930s, and specifically in 1939.
And why? What was it about the railroad that? Because there's such imagery in this film that evokes. I don't know. I guess it's about progress. What was it about?
DeMille's emphasis was, he was concerned about all of the isms, as he called them, that were threatening the world order, specifically with the oncoming of World War II. The war clouds rumbling in Europe, the fascists in Italy under Mussolini, the Nazis in Germany under Hitler. And he thought Americanism should be the thing that should be triumphing as a motion picture subject. And that is why, beginning in 1936, he made what film critics have called the DeMille's American Trilogy. In 1936, he made a story about Wild Bill Hickok called The Plainsman, starring Gary Cooper as Wild Bill Hickok. 1938, he made a film about Jean Lafitte and the American Revolution down in New Orleans called The Buccaneer. And the third film in this loosely structured trilogy was Union Pacific in 1939. Yeah. So DeMille was inherently a great booster of America and Americanism, and he did it in reaction to some of those constrictive and oppressive political movements around the world.
It's interesting when you see there's this foreword, as he describes it, as DeMille describes it right at the beginning of the film. And this just seems like something that DeMille did a good bit, where he has the kind of prologue. And in it, it says, "The legend of Union Pacific is the drama of the nation, tough and invincible, conquering the endless reaches of the West." So I guess this is the sentiment that he's trying to convey to the world.
America and Americans can do anything.
Yeah.
And his prologue to that film is certainly symbolic, although it may not have been in his own mind, but is symbolic of the tenor of the times and DeMille's optimism about the destiny of America. The railroad and the building of the Transcontinental Railroad was an expression of that optimism and that triumph over the early years of the Great Depression.
It's interesting, James, to see, and I think they're easy to see these days. I'm not sure if they would have been so obvious in 1939, but you see certainly bad actors, and I don't mean film actors, but bad characters as corporate villains, that's for sure. But you also see corporate leaders as heroes, and you see critics of, you know, free enterprise portrayed as kind of hysterical, trying to hold back progress. Did this represent DeMille's kind of conservative ideology, and where did that fit in the tenor of the time?
Well, Union Pacific, even though it plays very well to today's audiences, is certainly a product of its time. Yeah. The administration of Franklin D. Roosevelt came down hard on big business and big business tycoons, and other films of the late 1930s reflect this. For example, the 1939 20th Century Fox film Jesse James, starring Tyrone Power, has a similar foreword to Union Pacific, but it's much more direct in terms of how it positions the railroad. It called the railroad in this introduction an ogre, taking land away from people so that the railroad could run through this particular part of the land in Missouri where Jesse James was growing up. He used the fact that the railroads were predatory, and that's a word from the introduction to the film, to begin his career of train robbing. So big business was often pictured as the predator and as the ogre. And another film that elucidates this theme is the contemporary drama, The Grapes of Wrath, made 1 year later in 1940, where sharecroppers are thrown off the land and have to move west.
So, but is DeMille sort of representing the conservative argument against that idea? Because he does seem to be quite pro-corporate interest in some way, pro-free enterprise.
DeMille was very much pro-enterprise, and he was actually anti-union at the time and left a lucrative radio career in the mid-1940s with Lux Radio Theater in protest of that. What he does in Union Pacific, he plays both ends against the middle.
Huh.
He shows the public-spirited businessman, but focuses on the greedy one in Asa Barrows, who's trying to play stock options and make millions by sabotaging the Union Pacific and buy shares in Central Pacific. So he's playing both parts off one another with the better business interests triumphing at the end.
Let me play a moment. This is early on. It's one of the first things we see, and this is playing out not in the Western expanse, but in Washington, D.C., where there's this debate going on in the Senate about the railroad. Because I want to put this in the perspective of the 1860s as well, and you can help us with that. But let me play this moment. These are senators debating about whether or not this railroad should in fact be supported by the government, by whether or not this is in the interest of the public or just corporate interests. Here's a moment from Cecil B. DeMille's film, Union Pacific.
In all this broad land of ours, who wants this railroad that will start at the outer edge of civilization and wander expensively through the wilderness? Who, I ask you, except a small group of money-grabbing financiers, self-seeking politicians, and fanatical engineers.
Mr. President. Mr. Sergeant. Gentlemen, the learned senator asks, who wants this railroad? Well, I'll tell you. This nation, crippled by 4 years of war, wants it. A great artery through which may flow the gold and silver of the West into the empty treasuries of the East, grain and cattle into a war-torn South, and thousands of men released from both armies want it for the work and the wages it will bring. And the merchants of the whole world who need a shorter route to the Orient, they want it.
Does this, in some way, pretty dramatic, of course, but does it portray the debate that was going on in Washington in the 1860s?
It portrays the argument perfectly. And DeMille's writers do what good screenwriters do. They boil down the chief arguments and points of view into a very concentrated and dramatic confrontation, as they did in the hall of the Senate there. There were people in the 1860s who saw dollar signs in building the railroad west. Others saw a needless expenditure of public funds, suspecting that there would be considerable federal patronage, corruption, and business interests involved. And the answer that one could give to the question, well, which one prevailed? And the answer is yes.
Right.
Both of those areas prevailed, but in different degrees as the trail of the tracks moved west and the Central Pacific tracks moved east. It wasn't specific the corruption, the pettiness, the greed, or the heroism to Union Pacific. It also happened in the building of the Central Pacific as well. So there was this constant struggle during the building of the Transcontinental Railroad to balance the greedy profiteering efforts versus the public service and public-spirited goal of building the railroad in the first place, which is why Abraham Lincoln signed the railroad bill in 1862.
Yeah, the image of Abraham Lincoln, at least his hand, appears in the film. I guess a reference to the idea that he had faith in the future of the railroad and that this was the future of the country and that this was going to bind the wounds of the nation, I suppose.
Yes, and to show just Abraham Lincoln's hand signing the document is part of the DeMille drama, because we all know what happened, and the viewers knew what happened to Abraham Lincoln, the assassinated president. So it puts this railroad bill and this entire project with an imprimatur of the martyred president. This must go on. It must be completed. It is for the public good. And let's see how this works out during the course of the film.
What do you know about DeMille's, how this idea came to Cecil B. DeMille? Do we know much about that? What was his interest in it? And when does he come up with the love triangle? Because you can't, I guess you could, but it would be difficult to get an audience to come watch this idea of corporate greed and free enterprise play out for 2 hours plus. You got to have a love interest in there as well. So how did that all work?
Well, remember, these are popular motion pictures, and DeMille, perhaps more than any other film producer and director, knew that if you were teaching a history lesson to an audience, that would be the last film you would ever make.
Right.
So the film has to have ingredients that are pre-sold to an audience. Epic scale effort and industry, and the building of the Transcontinental Railroad is perfect for that. I mean, John Ford did it in 1924 with a silent epic called The Iron Horse, and it was surefire box office about the building of the Transcontinental Railroad. So DeMille was building on not only an American subject of great drama, but a pre-sold drama as well. He knew people would respond to it. Now, as far as the love interest is concerned, usually the plot of two men in love with the same woman is an oft-used plot in motion pictures, especially during the 1930s and 40s. In fact, it was often joked about. DeMille, however, instructed his writers to do a love story that would be unlike any other. And I can't tell too much more for those who are listening who haven't seen the film, but it has a really dramatic ending and resolution in this love affair at the end of the film that your listeners will just have to see.
Yeah.
That is part of the DeMille magic. He would work and work and work with his team of writers to get things just right, including calling one of them, Jesse Lasky Jr., at odd hours, wee hours of the morning, saying, "Jesse, what have you done with this bit of business in this scene? Or how do we improve the love scene? Or I didn't like this point of dialogue. Can you come up with something tomorrow?" And Lasky was beside himself getting these nocturnal phone calls from the producer and director of the film. But that's how DeMille made the films that the American public were anxiously looking forward to each year, because he only made one feature film a year.
James Dark, he's a film historian, author of the book When Hollywood Came to Utah. So next Wednesday, we're going to be screening Cecil B. DeMille's Union Pacific. This is part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. James Dark is going to be there for a pre-film discussion and a presentation. It all begins at 7 o'clock. That's next Wednesday at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. You can get more details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. Okay.
Support for KUER comes from the local and national businesses around the state that underwrite our programming. Shows like Morning Edition, Radio West, and All Things Considered. If your business or organization cares about the in-depth local news and fascinating conversations you can only find on public radio, team up with KUER. To learn more about becoming an underwriter, look for the Support tab at KUER.org and click on Business Support.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are observing the 150th anniversary of the meeting of the Transcontinental Railroad by showing a movie, talking about a movie, an old Western from Cecil B. DeMille called Union Pacific, made in 1939. We're going to be screening the film next week. It's part of our film series with the Utah Film Center. So today in the program, we have with us the film historian James Dark, talking about Union Pacific. Let's talk about the role Utah plays, of course, in all of this. And we should mention that, again, you talked about the fact the country's in the middle of the Depression, and southern Utah, Cedar City in particular, where we'll focus all of this, was really struggling. Talk about how this, or a good part of this film, comes to Iron County in Utah.
The filming of much of Union Pacific was shot in Iron County around the vicinity of Cedar City near a train stop called Iron Springs, way out on the rolling prairie. This has to do with the efforts of three enterprising brothers by the name of Perry, who came from Salt Lake City to Cedar City in the early 19-teens to make their millions. They founded an automobile dealership, a large commercial laundry, and eventually one of them, Gronway Perry, became mayor of Cedar City. They also bought the transportation concession to Zion National Park, Bryce Canyon, and the Grand Canyon. So they were looking for any kind of enterprise to make some money and make a name for themselves. Chauncey Perry, the oldest brother, however, had been a pilot in World War I, and he spent the winter months taking pictures from an airplane of the beautiful scenery in the area and then going to Hollywood and shopping these pictures around studios, saying, "You make a lot of Westerns. They're made in the same places in California. Why don't you come up and see vistas like these?" And he would spread these photographs out. Well, he first got Tom Mix, the biggest Western star of the 1920s up there, to film a movie called The Deadwood Coach. And that began the trips that Hollywood Studios made to Utah. He was successful in convincing Paramount Pictures, and DeMille in particular, to do some filming up in the Cedar City area because it had the Union Pacific Railroad tracks already there, a station at Iron Springs, and a lot of willing people in Cedar City who could come out and be extras, wranglers, guards, greensmen, construction builders. This was a boon because it was during the Great Depression, but Utah suffered more than most states in that they had an agricultural depression as well. Shooting for 1 month, as Paramount did in that area, brought tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars into the local economy. And John Ford came soon after that to film his Technicolor film of the Revolutionary War, Drums Along the Mohawk, starring Henry Fonda, right on Cedar Mountain, just above Cedar City. And the trail from Hollywood to Los Angeles, or Hollywood to Utah, became a rutted road with all the movie companies that would soon come over the next 30 years to that area.
You mention in your book when Hollywood came to Utah. It wasn't actually Cecil B. DeMille who came. It was it was the second unit film crew that came to Cedar City in 1938, the fall of 1938. Second unit director, a man by the name of Arthur Rawson, was doing the directing here. But I guess it was still a pretty big production, those scenes. There's a lot. I mean, they were trying to portray that chaotic Cheyenne, Wyoming, and it was fascinating to see all those scenes.
That's
a lot
right.
Going on.
Second unit production is when the crew and extras go to a particular location where the principal performers are not needed, and they shoot all of his background footage, and in the case of Union Pacific, the entire town of Cheyenne, the detailed shots of the laying of the track, chase scenes on horses. So I estimate that when you include the actual footage and then the rear projection footage, while there is action by the principal performers in the foreground, at least two-thirds of Union Pacific is seen on the screen that was shot in Utah.
Wow. Let's talk about the actors that people who come to watch the film on Wednesday will see. Joel McRae, I think some may know who he is. He wasn't a Gary Cooper, and I guess Gary Cooper, you've said, is who DeMille had in mind for this particular role. But McRae was handsome, tall. He must have been something of a screen idol for his time.
McRae was an incredible actor up to that time. He was in a thrilling early 1930s drama called The Most Dangerous Game with Faye Ray. He was in a number of rather continental-type dramas, Sullivan's Travels with Veronica Lake, directed by Preston Sturges. He was an all-around really good actor. But where he and DeMille came to know one another was that Joel McRae was his newspaper boy. And DeMille loved the way he got the newspaper right up on his doorstep. And he had a good eye for actors, characters, the look of what an actor should be. So he asked him if he'd like a bit part in DeMille's first talking picture called Dynamite in 1929. And that began Joel McRae's film career. And it was a very good career. So by 1939... DeMille wanted Gary Cooper to be Jeff Butler, the Union Pacific Railroad troubleshooter, but Cooper had commitments at Warner Brothers and at Sam Goldwyn Productions. He couldn't do it. So he offered the job to Joel McRae, and McRae knew that he was the second choice, but he said, "No, Chief," as DeMille was often called, "I'll take the part." And he was very, very good. He was Cooper-esque in the way that he was big and broad-shouldered and very soft-spoken. But as you see in the movie, he gets the job done.
Yeah, that's right. Well, he's the hero in this and part of this love triangle. The other part of the love triangle, the male part, is Robert Preston, who's the kind of the anti-hero figure. And I have to say, Preston is really great in this role. You say this was a breakout role for him.
This was a breakout role for Robert Preston, who most of your listeners will know from The Music Man, Professor Harold Hill. Yep. He got his start in the mid-1930s, had a couple of bit parts, but being in a Cecil B. DeMille movie, you were on the map after that. They complained that they didn't get paid very much, but they didn't need to be, because when you were seen in a DeMille picture, other filmmakers would consider you for a role. In fact, Preston was so intense in his performance in this film that DeMille put him in his next big epic, his first film in Technicolor, Northwest Mounted Police, in 1940. So DeMille gave Robert Preston an incredible boost to his very successful career.
And say something about Barbara Stanwyck. She's great. You have to sort of look the other way on her Irish brogue that she has throughout. But she's really good in the movie, I think.
DeMille said, at the risk of facing a lot of criticism, that the best actress that he ever worked with was Barbara Stanwyck. She was prepared. She knew her lines. She knew the marks where she had to be. She had a tremendous presence. And she graces this film not only with warmth and sentiment, but with a fiery spirit that mixes well with the two men who are in love with her. And yes, the Irish brogue, you get used to it after a while.
Yeah, you do.
But, Doug, this was done all the time in movies in the 1930s and 40s. and because movies were star-powered and audiences were star-oriented, as long as they were credible, they didn't care the various roles that stars were brought to portray on the screen. And she does a great, great job in Union Pacific, both in terms of humor, romance, and tragedy.
I'm going to play a scene with Barbara Stanwyck. She's plays Molly. One of the and this is to give us a sense of how much of a Babylon these places were, these towns that would crop up along the line as they were building. And the idea was that the corrupt person, you mentioned Sid Campo, he's creating brothels and bars as a way of distracting the Union Pacific workers. And so Molly, in this particular scene, an Irish immigrant who's working on the railroad, a guy by the name of Paddy, gets killed in a bar fight by Anthony Quinn, by the way, an actor who played by Anthony Quinn, which is really interesting. And he's just shot. And you get a sense of how lawless all of this is. And Molly is over his body and she's lamenting that. Let me play this scene because I want to have you talk a little bit about it. Here's Barbara Stanwyck. She's playing Molly in Cecil B. DeMille's film, Union Pacific.
A lad lies murdered, and nothing will be done about it. From a far country he came to do his little part building the railway. A great and good thing for us all. And what will you tell his widow? You men that run this hell on wheels. That's what it is. Hell on wheels that claims a man's life for every day in the year.
You get a sense of the kind of drama, over-the-top writing maybe, which was appropriate for the time, I'm sure. But say a little bit about this idea that where Molly fits in all of this and what she's trying to convey here.
Well, Molly is a career person on the railroad. She was born and lived on the railroad and believed in the purpose of the Union Pacific and the Transcontinental Railroad. It's interesting that you take that particular excerpt and refer to it as over-the-top writing and maybe even acting. But when it's taken out of the context of the film, yes, it certainly sounds like that and it comes across like that. However, when you see it in the overall context of the film, there's a little tear that might appear in your eye as well.
Yeah.
Barbara Stanwyck knew how to bleed the emotion out of the scene, and she does it so well. And when you see it in that part of the motion picture, you're right along with her.
Well, while you're talking about Indians in DeMille films, let's talk a little bit about how they're portrayed. Let me play a scene that will sort of get us into this part of the conversation. This is a moment where we will hear from the Joel McRae character, Jeff Butler. We'll also hear from the bad guy, Sid Campo. You'll hear Molly in here as well. And you'll hear Dick Allen, played by Robert Preston. What has just happened is, and it's pretty startling, I have to say, is they're going along and there's an American Indian riding along with the train. Someone, a bad guy, cavalierly takes his gun, opens the window, and shoots the man dead. And so this sets off this fight. Let me play a moment here. The first you'll hear is Jeff Butler, but as I said, you'll hear the others here in this scene from Union Pacific.
Hey, conductor, stop the train. One of my men got thrown off.
You're thrown off where?
Don't pull that cord, conductor.
But Mr. Campo said...
This train doesn't stop.
All right.
That shot didn't just kill an Indian. Killed a dozen white men and scalped and tortured women and children.
What's a dead Indian, more or less? The Army's been killing them for years.
The Army doesn't kill Indians for fun, Campo. And I don't think you do, either.
He's sure gonna be unpopular.
Not with me.
So, It's so interesting, the contrast in the way Native Americans are portrayed in this film. On one hand, you get the sort of the stereotypes of Indians in movies. They're referred to as savages and red devils. On the other hand, you say DeMille was really careful about the Native Americans that he hired, at least for this film in particular. So talk a little bit about what listeners who come to the film on Wednesday are going to see, because they're going to see some stereotypes there for sure.
Well, they will see stereotypes because some of those stereotypes are a product of its time, to be sure.
Sure.
But DeMille was a cut above the other filmmakers in this regard. He wanted historical accuracy, even though he acknowledged to his audience, his viewers, that there were fictional storylines. He was very careful about how he portrayed Native Americans in these films. He hired Native Americans from five different tribes to portray in the Indian tribes of the 1860s in his film. And he also consulted with a Native American and an Indian chief, Chief Big Tree, who appeared in movies as a consultant to the film. And there is correspondence with Chief Big Tree in the Cecil B. DeMille papers at Brigham Young University. Mm. He wanted to be sure that he got both sides of the discussion in his film. And I'm glad you played the scene that he did, because it reflects DeMille's sense of balance in writing so many of the wrongs about the traditional, stereotypical us versus them argument. And this is textbook DeMille.
Which means what, Jim? I think some people will see a dated impression for sure. But what you're saying is for Cecil B. DeMille, certainly for the time, 1939, he was more interested in a more nuanced perception of Native people.
Precisely.
Is that what you're saying? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And when you see other Westerns of the time, such as John Ford's Stagecoach, you'll get the stereotypical approach. So compared with the other filmmakers of his time, and I think that's the only fair way to judge this, he was a cut above the standard depiction of Native Americans as human beings to be eliminated. In Union Pacific, while he doesn't drive this as a major point, they were in that area first. Treaties were made with them. And as Jeff Butler implies in his statement from the clip you played, we have to honor those agreements. And the U.S. Army doesn't kill Indians just for fun. That definitely is a different point of view than you would find in the Saturday afternoon Westerns in America's theaters during the 1930s.
Yeah. There's a moment, I won't give away too much. I'm glad you're being careful about that. There's a moment when the cavalry literally shows up and there's this fanfare there. And it just almost seems like too perfect, you know? Like, that's such a movie. That's such a Hollywood movie. The cavalry actually arrives with this fanfare in the background.
Faster, faster!
Kind of great, right?
Well, like you use the term perfect. Well, of course it's perfect. It's the movies. Yeah. Orson Welles once referred to motion pictures as a ribbon of dreams. People in the 1930s and at any age went to the movies primarily not to be educated, but to escape. Escape the doldrums, particularly during the 1930s, of the Great Depression through which they were living. But one has to think of, all right, escape is a good reason as far as it goes, but what is the world that they are escaping to? It has to be a world that they find agreeable, stimulating, and entertaining. And when the cavalry comes, whether in Union Pacific or Stagecoach or any other cowboy and Indian film, what isn't stimulating and heroic and ennobling? What's better than that? It's an ingredient that just has to be in a Western film, and especially a Western film of this type. And few could do it better than Cecil B. DeMille.
We were talking earlier about DeMille's, at least at the time, skepticism about labor unions. And I wanted to play a moment that that kind of reveals all of that. There's this character named Duke Ring. Set this up for us, because I want to play this moment where he's trying to get the workers to stop working because they're being exploited by the railroad.
Duke Ring is a muscle-bound enforcer of Sid Campo, trying to sabotage the progress of Union Pacific. So he goes out to the end of track where some of the workers are perfecting the grade so that the track layers could come along and lay down the track. Well, he's convincing them that since their money has not arrived to pay them, that they should rise up and revolt against the foreman at Union Pacific and refuse to do any other work. Of course, it fulfills Sid Campo's design to stall the railroad, but he preys upon their sense of what someone might say the proletariat rising up against the management classes and just saying, I won't work.
What are you working for? It ain't money, because you don't get none. Are you working for your sweat? That's all you'll get out of it. Unless some engine comes along and tears the hair off your head. Give me that. You ain't going to need this.
I want to play the second part of this scene because Butler kind of gives them a speech. Not only does he humiliate and beat up Duke Ring, which is kind of a great scene, but he gives them this speech. You want to say something about this moment?
Well, this is where you get a popular motion picture about a time in the historical West that reflects more about contemporary views in the 1930s than it does in the 1860s. In the depths of the Great Depression, Americans began to flirt with various political philosophies, socialism, communism, and other systems, even fascism for a while, because to the rank and file American, the American political system and the American financial system doesn't appear to work anymore. So these ideas were flying around Hollywood and flying around the nation as well, and some people were beginning to consider them seriously. Well, DeMille was an ardent conservative. He had been to the Soviet Union. He did not like the Stalinist government and the communist system. And it's no surprise that he would have a scene like this in the film. So Duke Ring represents this socialist or fascist nature of ideas as they relate to the workers. And we have Jeff Butler coming in as the American cause and the American system, showing the workers there's another way to look at this, and there's a greater cause that we are all working for. So that you shouldn't pay attention to Duke Ring and his defeatist, subversive ideas that will end up just putting you out of work.
Your foreman was a fine fellow. This bruiser taking his place?
What are you going to do about it, Bucko?
Nothing, Mr. Ring. If these men are fools enough to believe a lying windbag like you...
Lying, am I? Have you been paid for 2 months or ain't you?
No.
Sure. You've all got wages coming. So have I. We'll get every cent that's due us. The railroad won't pay you for sitting around watching Mr. Ring break shovels. So let's go to work.
That sounds like horse sense.
Oh, does it? I'll kill the first man to move a shovel of earth.
You'll go out of here feet first, Bucko.
And there's a pretty good fight scene there, which is pretty fun, I have to say.
Well, and look at that as a classic confrontation of Americanism, capitalism, and patriotism versus communism and sedition.
DeMille, it's interesting the way he promoted this film. He wasn't the first to do this, but he basically went on a whistle-top tour to promote it. And one of the stops, one of the big stops, of course, was in Salt Lake City. And you've been reading a lot about this and talking a lot about this. And listeners who come next week are going to have a treat to have you perform the role of Cecil B. DeMille giving a speech. Tell us about this part. This is great.
Well, it's a lot of fun. Hollywood got the idea, and Warner Brothers Pictures was the first. In early April 1939, they premiered their big Technicolor Western Dodge City, starring Errol Flynn and Olivia de Havilland, in Dodge City itself. But they did it with an old train leaving Union Station in Los Angeles and doing a cross-country train trip all the way to Dodge City, Kansas, for the world premiere. And the footage from that in color was the trailer to the movie when it had its general release. Well, it got so much press and so much publicity and resulted in such a big box office that DeMille decided, since our story deals with trains explicitly, we're going to do the same thing. So the Union Pacific Special left Union Station in Los Angeles in April of 1939 and visited four or five major cities before ending up in Omaha, Nebraska, for the premiere, the headquarters of Union Pacific, for the premiere of the motion picture. Salt Lake City was the first stop, and he did a fascinating broadcast, shortwave hookup with KSL radio, as the train rolled into the Union Pacific Depot, where he covered the Utahns' efforts to build the railroad in the 1860s, and also reviewed some of the history of their filming the movie in Utah and invited Utahns to come down to the station and then later in the day participate in the huge parade down Main Street in Salt Lake City. And this is in advance of the premiere of the movie, and thousands did show up, including President Heber J. Grant of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, donning a top hat. And I will show pictures of that on the Wednesday, May 15th screening. So it was a fascinating broadcast. I found a transcript of that broadcast in the Cecil B. DeMille papers and will reenact that broadcast and the announcer's comments before the screening of the movie.
That's going to be great. Last question. Why is this interesting to watch today? A 1939 film about a 1869 event, about a form of transportation that doesn't seem exactly on the cutting edge these days. Why is this interesting to watch?
The joining of the rails and the driving of the Golden Spike and all of the history and the drama that coalesces in that one event has, I'm sure unintentionally, cast a long, long shadow on America, and maybe some light as well. At the time, the joining of the rails symbolized to what was a broken America, a civil war, the North versus the South. It symbolized a unity and coming together of the East and West coasts. But also, I think culturally, a unity of purpose, joining different landscapes, different cultures together in a United States. And I think those tenuous connections that are formed by very narrow iron rails and held together by spikes is symbolic, not only for that event, but during World War I, the Great Depression, World War II, in finding America united behind a single cause, and I would even say into the 1960s with Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement, all the way down to Rodney King, whose famous phrase was broadcast and has been remembered ever since, "Can't we get along?" And even up to 2019, when we experience so much political divisiveness in our country. The uniting of the East and West and the uniting of these rails symbolize that still the struggle, the desire, the optimism, the goal of becoming a united people. And I think the construction, the successful construction of the Transcontinental Railroad will always be a potent symbol of how in various ways America came together to achieve this incredible result. And to quote an old, maybe oft-used adage, we've done it before and we can do it again.
James Dark, he's a film historian and an emeritus film archivist at Brigham Young University, author of the book When Hollywood Came to Utah, which is being released in a new updated edition this coming summer. He's going to be with us next Wednesday night as we screen Cecil B. DeMille's Union Pacific. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. He'll be there for a pre-film discussion and a presentation. It all begins next Wednesday night at 7 o'clock at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. For more details, go to our website, radiowest.org. Dark joined us from Northern California, where he's conducting research for a new book project. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.